Welcome to Side Hustle City, and thanks for joining us. Our goal is to help you connect to real people who found success turning their side hustle into a main hustle, and we hope you can too. I'm Adam Kaler. I'm joined by Kyle Stevie, my co-host. Let's get started. All right, welcome back, everybody, to the Side Hustle City podcast. The trusty co-host is traveling the country still with his family. I believe he's in North Carolina. But we do have Stephanie Stuckey here on the show today. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Adam.
Oh, thank you so much for being on. And, you know, you're with Stuckey's, right, as your last name would indicate?
Right. Yes.
And if anybody's been to the South, like Kyle's driving around right now, he's in the South. He's probably sees pecans for sale, you know, all these little treats that people can stop in at Stuckey's and get. But talk a little bit about Stuckey's. Talk a little bit about the history. I think a lot of people have seen the sign. If they saw your logo right now, that's the thing that struck me. Like when I see the logo, I'm like, oh, Stuckey's. Yeah, I know Stuckey's.
Yeah, sure. So we have a crazy 87-year-old history. I joke that we're an 87-year-old startup because we've had our share of ups and downs since our beginning. So in 1937, my grandfather started Stuckey's as a side hustle. It was during the Great Depression. He had to drop out of law school and he was working the family farm, which he hated. He did not like farming cotton in South Georgia in the summer.
No.
Miserable.
Oh.
And it was a bumper pecan crop. And so he started buying pecans in the evenings from the local farmers. And he took them to a shelling plant, had them shelled. And then he opened a roadside stand. And he was selling pecans to motorists, people traveling. And this was during the Great Depression. So this was before TA or Pilots or Love's or Bucky's or 7-Eleven, none of those were around. There were no convenience stores. And he very quickly realized that motorists were looking for more than just a pecan snack. And he started developing candies, and then he got gas and restrooms and snacks and souvenirs. And that really is what became the world's first roadside retail chain, was Stuckey's. And he grew it to 368 stores in 40 states. He owned a candy plant, a trucking company, a billboard company.
Wow. How long did it take to get to 300 stores?
That was in the mid-1970s. That was really the peak of the brand. And what happened to us was he sold the company in 1964, a year before I was born. But he remained active and head of the Stuckey's division of the company. We were bought out by Pet Dairy Corporation. So he remained active and involved until the mid-70s. So the company continued to grow. But then Pet Dairy got a new CEO who did not get our quirky Southern brand, even though we were national at that point. The new CEO just didn't get the brand, and he ousted my grandfather. Oh, and then my grandfather died like 2 years after that. Oh, so the visionary founder was gone. It was out of our family hands. And then that company got bought out by another company. And our stores started getting shuttered. Instead of seeing our wonderful blue roof oasis on the side of the road, you would see shuttered stores, or even worse, a lot of our stores became corn shops and trucker bars. It was really sad to see my family business just plummet like that. That was a lot of my teenage years, was taking road trips and looking and saying, well, that used to be a Stuckey's. That used to be your grandfather's company. It was heartbreaking. And my dad got the company back in 1985 as a side hustle. He was running four other companies and was not looking to add to his portfolio. But Stuckey's was losing money. The last owner didn't want it. They pretty much gave it to my dad. And he kept Stuckey's alive for 30 plus years by pairing it with another one of his businesses. He had the franchise rights to Dairy Queen stores on the interstate highway system.
Whoa.
So he put Stuckey's next to Dairy Queen and kept Stuckey's alive with the infrastructure and the support and the branding and everything that came with having the Dairy Queen brand. Then he sold his Dairy Queen company in 2012 to Warren Buffett, who owns American Dairy Queen. So this complemented Warren Buffett's portfolio, which was great for my dad and for the Dairy Queen portion of his business. But that left Stuckey's just off on its own. And my dad and his business partners all retired and left Stuckey's with just a handful of people running it on autopilot. And they did a great job, but they lacked resources. They lacked structure. And within a decade, the company was six figures in debt.
Oh,
and that's when they came to me and asked me if I wanted to buy the family business. They actually didn't just go to me. My grandfather had seven grandchildren and they approached all of them. I was the only one who said yes. And I learned I was really not the first choice.
Oh, no.
I know.
They had to go through the eldest? And then they just kind of made their way down the list.
Yeah, but I think they went to the ones younger than me first. But hey, you know what? It's all good. And I'm grateful. And I said yes. And within 6 months, we started turning a modest profit despite COVID.
Oh, wow. So even during COVID.
To turn the brand around. And how we did it was, at that point, we didn't own or operate any of the stores. There were only 17 original locations still standing. We had a rented distribution facility. All of our product was outsourced. But what I did was, first, I just started marketing and branding and saying, this is such a great brand. Don't you remember road trips? Don't you remember how much fun it was going to Weeki Wachee and South of the Border and all these other fun roadside attractions, and remembering that fun time of the road trip? And people started resonating with that and remembering the brand. And we really ramped up our online presence. And I realized that in order to survive, we would have to start selling more product. That really was the key to our profit. Was we were making money from selling pecan log rolls and pecan snacks that were branded Stuckey's, but we weren't making them. So I got a business partner. We got an SBA loan. I am all for government handouts, government programs. Like, get it. I mean, we pay for that as taxpayers.
Yeah, yeah. You're just getting your money back. And then you're going to read. Yeah. Yeah.
So I know how to read these government programs. And I used to run an environmental nonprofit. So my background is I'm an environmental attorney. So I just started, we applied for all the PPP funds. That helped us get profitable. And then we applied for an SBA 7A loan. My business partner, who is amazing, he and I jointly bought a candy plant and a pecan shelling plant. And then we started selling our product to all these different retail outlets. We went from being in maybe a couple hundred retail outlets when I bought the company to we're approaching about 5,000 retail outlets now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, wow. Large chains. So you can get some of these large chains and overnight you're in 1,000 more stores, right?
Yeah, true.
And we're expanding. We're in the process of looking for another facility to add to our existing facility. So we'll keep what we have and then we want to add another facility.
Do you still practice law?
I do for Stuckey's.
Oh, okay, for Stuckey's. Because that's a big transition.
The chief marketing officer. And I do a fair amount of the contract work. And then the specialized stuff, I farm out. We have actually my cousin Vinny, he's a lawyer. My cousin Alan is a lawyer.
Well, look at that.
So we're keeping in the family.
You guys as entrepreneurs and lawyers in your family, it sounds like.
Yes, yes. And this is all about the side hustle. So I would love to say how my grandfather really made it during those lean years, because he wasn't an overnight success. It took him a decade to really start seeing a real profit. So he had a car dealership. He sold railroad ties. He had nightclubs that sold alcohol in a dry county.
Oh, ooh, yeah. Okay. Okay. Your grandpa was a hustler. Look at him.
Yeah.
He did. And then you all became lawyers. What's going on? Like he was bucking the system and then you guys were all about law.
Yeah. Yeah. So he had, back in the day, they called them juke joints. So okay. J-U-K-E, I think maybe because they had jukeboxes.
But, probably.
So yeah. He had juke joints out in the country. And the car dealership, he had Stuckey cars, Stuckey auto. So just constantly making sure he had additional income. And then my father had numerous businesses. And then when I bought Stuckey's, I think what a lot of entrepreneurs don't realize is that you have to give yourself a pretty good runway. And think of what the runway is that you need and double it. I thought I needed a year. I really needed 2 years. I didn't start drawing any income from the company until a couple months ago.
Oh, wow.
At the two and a half year mark.
That makes sense. That does. That actually makes a lot. Well, especially for a company your size that's, you know, I mean, you've got an entire supply chain you have to rebuild. I mean, that wasn't, you know, I mean, you have a physical product, a physical location. You know, there's a lot of moving pieces. This isn't, you know, an online business. I mean, and look back at what your grandpa started. I mean, there was no YouTube back then where you could just get on and do a search for how to start a business, how to make money at a roadside, you know, business selling pecans. You couldn't just look that up and something pop up, right? He had to learn by trial and error. And like you said, it took years to do that. Well, here you are, an environmental attorney trying to run this legacy business that your grandpa, you know, knew everything about, you know, and your father, obviously, you know, an entrepreneur. And here you are, you know, a student of law trying to build a business that requires a lot of skills.
Are you tired of feeling lost in the world of trading and investing? Get informed and inspired with the Talking Trading podcast. I'm Louise Bedford, and I'll help you navigate the markets like a pro. Tune in each week and subscribe now at talkingtrading.com.au or on your favorite podcast app, or check out the link in the show notes. Talking Trading, this is how traders excel.
But you know what I did? The most interesting part of it is when I bought the company, our assets were a trademark, which has some
value. Yeah, you had a brand. Yep.
And we had inventory in the warehouse, but we rented the warehouse. We didn't own the warehouse. And a lot of that inventory hadn't turned in years. So we had some dead and dying inventory. I'm sure there's a better technical term for it, but we literally had a spreadsheet that had a column entitled dead inventory.
Yeah. Yeah. It's whatever you want to call it. It's whatever you want to call it internally.
Yeah. There was another, it was slow moving. And then there was just dead, like stick a fork in it. This inventory is dead. No one. And we put under that dead inventory, it's a bit of an aside, but I think it's funny. We had like six cases of Britney Spears t-shirts in the dead inventory column, and she made a comeback. So thank God.
Oh, wow. I was going to say those are like retro now, right?
Yeah. So you never know when some of that dead inventory might
resurface and
back. Yeah,
yeah, it'll, be a
it'll
thing
rise
again.
From the dead.
Wow.
So I'm a huge Britney Spears fan. She's made a comeback and we sold her t-shirts. But what I did was I got my grandfather's paper. So in addition to that inventory and the trademark, the most valuable thing I got were 5-6 boxes of his archives that my mom gave me that had been in storage, and nobody had looked at those papers for 50 years.
Whoa.
And so I would spend my evenings after I was trying to revive his company reading his papers to understand the business, because I didn't grow up in the business. It'd been sold before I was born, and I was a little kid. I just knew him as my grandfather. I didn't know him as a businessman. So I discovered my grandfather as a businessman in a whole new light, and I read how he made his money. And he didn't make his money owning and operating stores. He didn't own or operate any of the stores either. So that gave me hope. I thought, how are we going to do this? We don't own these stores. And the franchise agreements were completely in disarray, and we were making almost no income from them. And I realized he made his money from product, and he made most of his money from pecans and from pecan-based candies.
Interesting.
And he owned the manufacturing. And there it was. There's how he did it. So I did what he did.
So you spent hours, hours reading through all this documentation that, 50-year-old papers. Yeah. I mean, that's got, brittle and everything else. And here you are reading through this stuff and finally uncover, you know, what he started the original business as was the most profitable part of the business because he controlled the manufacturing and packaging.
That's right. And it wasn't like there was this gleaming document, lights coming down that, this is the strategic plan for Stuckey's. I don't know if they had strategic plans.
You just had to surmise it through all of this stuff. Yeah, you had to stitch it all.
I had to piece it together. Like, here's an interview he did. Here's a letter he wrote. Here's an article on the Stuckey Sweet Talk newsletter magazine. It was all just piecing together. And I had it all spread out on my table. And I had like a spreadsheet where I was putting things in columns and figuring it out. And I thought, it was just like I had this moment, like, wait, he sold product. That's how he got rich, not from the store. So I can do it the way he did it.
Yeah. Yeah. And now you guys, at its peak, you said there was over 300 stores?
368. And so all those stores were selling his product. So I wish I could have a business model he did, because he provided all of the product for those stores.
Wow.
So he had a distribution facility, and everything that was sold in the Stuckey's came from his distribution facility. So he would either make the product in his manufacturing facility that was also on site. You know, he had the distribution and the manufacturing all in one big complex. So he would manufacture and distribute. And then some of the product we sold, like if you went to Stuckey's back in the day, we have all these kitschy souvenirs. So rubber alligators, coonskin caps, Wee Wee Willie statues, Dunkin' Birds, snow globes, souvenir spoons. It goes on and on. T-shirts, just souvenirs. And so he sourced those from a whole group of vendors that he worked with. And then he would have them shipped to his warehouse, and then he would mark it up.
Yeah.
So he was making margin on a smaller margin because he had to source the product externally, but then he was making margin on that. And then he was making a larger margin on the product he made himself. And then he was making margin on the gas. He had an exclusive deal with Texaco, and he got a percentage of every gallon sold. And I learned reading his papers that gas money went 100% to him personally. It did not go to the company.
No way. Yeah. Wow. Wow. Yeah. You sound like he was worth a fortune. Golly. He was an oil magnate.
It's crazy. And my mom told me the story once. She said that she was talking to him, and my grandfather said, I've made so much money, your kids are never going to be able to spend it all. And I said, Mom, they managed to spend it all.
And then inflation happened over and over again, year after year.
Let me tell you, second and third generation of fortune, they can run through that money.
Oh, yeah, they can. Oh, yeah. If they didn't make it. Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, you don't understand how hard it is to make those dollars. You didn't have to struggle to make them. And it just seems like this endless supply, like this fountain of money that's never going to end.
I know. It's like we managed to spend every penny of it. And you know what? I'm very grateful because thanks to him, he left me a trust fund that funded my education. So I went to the best private schools. I love public schools too, but I went to great private schools, and I went to Vanderbilt University, and then I went to the University of Georgia undergrad. I transferred, and then I went to University of Georgia Law School. And I was on what I call the Stuckey Scholarship.
Yeah.
And it was only available to heirs of my grandfather, and he paid for my education, and I'm grateful.
Wow. Yeah. Cause that's not cheap nowadays.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the money was run through, and I'm not casting aspersions. It's just a funny story. And it happens all the time. People can spend money if it's given to them.
You can spend it faster than it can compound in the, you know, whatever investment vehicle he had it in at the time, I guess. You know, and people just wear it out. And I think that's one of the things too, is like, I think I read in The Millionaire Mind one time, it was talking about 75% of people that are wealthy actually grew up poor, not middle class, poor. 75 to 80%.
Really? Yes.
And 40% of people that grew up rich end up middle class.
Yeah.
A lot of it's drugs, but but they also just blow it because they didn't make it.
A lot of it.
Yeah, they don't appreciate it.
I went to a private school, like I said, with some wealthy families, third generation wealth, fourth generation wealth, and some of the most screwed up kids I've seen.
Oh, yeah.
Had very large trust funds. I know it's a bit of a digression from the side hustle, but get back to the topic. You're right. If you have to work for it, if you have to do 2-3 side hustles and you're living off of ramen noodles, which I have been lately, it's going to mean a lot more.
That's right.
And you're going to succeed.
Yeah. Well, and it's, this is important.
Out of adversity. It really does.
Yeah. Yeah. Pressure makes diamonds, right? So the thing is a lot of people, this would be a good problem for people to have if you make so much money off your side hustle that now you got to worry about your kids blowing it. Like that, this is where we want people to be, right? This is, yeah. So yeah, if you're listening right now, if you're hustling, you're doing your thing, you're creating an empire, you're going to create a franchise, whatever it is, you know, like Stephanie's grandfather did, you know, be sure to set it up right so your kids can succeed. I always said, like, hey, if I ever did that and I became like a billionaire or something, I'd make my kids think I was poor still. Like I'd raise them to think that they didn't have any money, you know, that kind of stuff. And yeah, yeah. Like even
you gotta keep your edge. You gotta make them work.
You got to.
My kids have to work because I didn't have a ton of money, but I had enough to buy Stuckey's, what was left of it. I mean, it was in debt, so I could afford it, but it cost my life savings. And to get to the point of the side hustle, so I didn't draw an income until just recently. And so how I supported myself, you have to be resourceful. I have an Airbnb. So my house is a duplex and I was living in the whole house. And I just had one half set aside. I completely redid half of my house and turned half of my house into an Airbnb. So basically, I shrunk the size of my house in half and made half of my house an Airbnb. So
it's a great idea.
The house. I made an investment in renovating the house and making it an Airbnb.
Where are you at? What state are you in? Or are you close to like a major metro?
Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, yeah. Well, they just put a law in place now. You can't own more than 2 Airbnbs in Atlanta.
Yeah. And I'm glad it's not my business model, but I think the intent of Airbnb, and I read the Airbnb story, which I absolutely love. They intended it to be people like me that have a guest house, have an extra room. I mean, the whole term Airbnb, it came from an air mattress. So the original intent was if you had an Airbnb, the first 100 people who were in the program as hosts, they literally had to have an air mattress. And it was people who just had an extra room in their house kind of thing.
Wow.
So I feel like I'm very much the embodiment of what Airbnb was intended to be because it's my house and I love it because it's right next door. So I can be doing a pitch to a major retail account. This has happened before. I was pitching to an account. They have 600 stores. And I finished the Zoom meeting pitch. And I literally ran next door and was scrubbing toilets and changing sheets.
Oh, my goodness.
At the Airbnb. So it keeps you humble.
It does keep you humble. Yeah, yeah. Look at you. You come from all this, like all this wealth and excess over the years, you know. And then here you are, like probably the last generation to benefit from all of what your grandfather did, but you're appreciative of what the little that he did have to give you still, you're appreciative of that and probably unappreciative of all the previous generations that really screwed it up for you. But the fact that like even your dad picked up on what your grandpa did, he was a businessman.
My dad did a lot of work. He's very much alive and he's been supportive in his own way.
Okay. Hey, it sounds like he's busy. Like he can only do so much, right?
Are you up? If you're not up and working, you are not hustling.
Oh man, he is from the South.
I'm like, yeah, Dad, I get up at 5 and I don't take a nap. You get up at 5 and you take a nap. That's the difference between us. But anyway, he gets me up. Yeah. But the other side hustle that I think is a great side hustle, and I just started doing it recently, is speeches.
Oh, so you're able to monetize those. See, I get asked to speak at all these events for like crypto and blockchain and real estate and everything else. And I just do it and just, you know, I don't make any money off of it, but I do it just to.
I did that for a year and a half. And then we have a board, and my board asked me about my travel schedule, and I was away a fair amount giving these speeches. And they said, are you getting paid for these speeches? And I said, well, I got an honorarium for $1,000 once. And they said, no, your time is worth more than that. And I was also doing all these Rotary clubs, and I love Rotary.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely love Rotary, but it's killing me. The Rotary clubs are killing me. And they said, you got to stop that. You cannot keep doing free speeches. And so a lot of side hustles is knowing your value.
Yep.
And knowing that you have something that is worth monetizing and appreciating that and being able to have the confidence to ask what you are worth, which I think sometimes is harder for women.
Oh no. My wife tells me to do that. She's like, you need to quit giving away your time.
It's not always,
but she's a boss. She's a boss too.
That's great.
She owns her own spa business. So, and she's doing really, really great. When I met her, she had, she was working in the back of this salon, you know, and you got the spa in the back of the salon a lot of times. And they're like the redheaded stepchild. We had to walk through all the people doing hair to get back to her. And I asked her one time, I was like, how many clients do you have? She said, oh, I think there's like 900 that come in on just different times, you know, but they had 900 clients. And I was like, so you meet with 900 people. I was like, why don't you just start your own business? Because you have a personal relationship with these people, right?
Yeah.
And so started her own business. She's hired several people. It's really hard in that business to find in cosmetology, to find someone who's qualified to do what she does, because she has a biology degree. But she works really, really hard. She's doing a lot of social media stuff. She's doing videos on YouTube, a lot of the stuff I see you doing, right? Because you have to get your message out there about your brand, and she's killing it now. I mean, killing it. I mean, this is probably averages $400 an hour, something like that. When the time that, she's there. Oh, these facials are not cheap. This is not cheap stuff. And it's all natural. Like, she's doing all natural stuff. She doesn't do any of that Botox. She doesn't believe in it. You know, it's botulism that you're injecting in your face. So she's like, none of that. But, you know, she got a biology degree. She was pre-med. It's what she knew, right? Which is a lot of what side hustlers do. Like, you create a business about something you're passionate about or that you understand, right?
Yes.
And
realize you can get paid for it. You can get paid for doing what you love. Because if you're passionate about something, you bring that to your work, and people will want to be part of that, and they're willing to pay for it.
That's right.
And I started asking for money for my speeches. And the best advice I got for asking for money was actually when I was in public office. So I was a state representative in Georgia for 14 years, and I had to fundraise for my campaigns, which was hard for me. And I was supposed to ask some of these potential donors for $1,000, which seems like a lot of money for me to ask someone.
I hate asking people for money. I hate it. Like, I would rather fund my campaign that I'm doing right now than, and I know how much it costs because I look at some of these others, and you probably did the same thing where you look at other districts next year's or the current district and they just redid our district. So you can't even, there's nothing to base it on. So I have to look at other districts and like what they raise. And you know, a lot of these people in order to win raise somewhere in like the $40,000 to $70,000 range.
My races cost $100,000.
Yeah. Well, in Georgia too.
I mean, Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, way more competitive.
$100,000. Yeah. And that was my last race was 2010. So it's gone up. So in any event, the best advice I got was from Emily's List, which does political advocacy for pro-choice Democratic women. I was a Democrat. I'm still a Democrat, but my brand is not. So I'm very careful not to be political and how we message.
You got to be careful. Yeah, exactly.
Brand.
Oh yeah.
So that's very much like my personal side, but it is public record that I was elected as a Democrat. So there's no secret there. But in any event, Emily's List, the training, they said, when you ask someone for money, you make the ask, you force yourself to say it with confidence, and you'll say, so I very much would like for you to donate $1,000 to my campaign. And this is the trick. You pause. after you make that ask and to force yourself to make that ask, they say, get a bottle of water, glass of water, whatever. Maybe you need a glass of beer or whiskey, whatever. But you have a bottle of water. And then when you say, I would like for you to donate $1,000 to my campaign, or I'm asking for $1,000, then you take that sip.
Mm.
And you know why? Because
that's the pause.
I know for me, I would say immediately I'd start negotiating against myself if I didn't force the pause. I would say, I know that's a lot of money and I know times are tough and it's okay if you can't give it. I understand. It's like, no, shut the F up. You're worth it. So fast forward, I'm asking for money for my speeches. And I would very much like, you know, I'm now getting $10,000 for a speech. Take your sip of water. And sometimes they'll say, or 20,000, I'm actually getting 20,000, depending on the complexity. If it's a local speech, there's not a lot of travel involved. It's a group that's very much in my space where I'm going to be getting some connections that are valuable to Stuckey's by speaking to the National Grocers, for example, then that's a different scenario, but just depending on the scenario, but make the ask.
Yeah.
And then let them say, that is way past our budget. And you can say, all right, well, what's your budget? Then you start negotiating. Don't start off negotiating against yourself.
That totally makes sense. And I mean, you have a good background. I mean, the fact that you're an attorney, for one, I mean, that gives you, you know, the ability to negotiate. You have to, most people that are attorneys, I think, probably have the personality type of a debater or somebody who can negotiate in the first place. And then your experience as an attorney probably helped you with that as well. So you had it there. And I think probably with you know, you're like, oh, I'm going to be this environmental attorney. You know, we're going to do things. I mean, you know, being a Democrat, it's like a, you know, I'm going to, you know, maybe even a little activism kind of thing going on in there too. So you got all this energy and, you know, I'm going to change the world. And here you are running your grandpa's business, right?
Yeah.
But career change. You didn't even probably think about it, but the skills that you were acquiring, the fact you grew up in a household with an entrepreneur, right? Being an attorney, understanding the law, right? Being able to read, because some of this stuff in business, when you're reading these, you know, documents or you're thinking about franchising or you're negotiating with partners on things, I mean, you got to be able to read the details, right?
Yes.
So a lot of that prepared you probably for what you're doing now.
100%. And takeaway for some of the listeners is we all have different life experiences that we bring to the table, and we don't recognize them sometimes for the value that they hold. Because I think especially in business, there's this perception that to be skilled at being an executive, for example, you have to have an MBA or you have to have a finance degree. And absolutely, that's helpful. I'm by no means saying you should not understand how to read a balance sheet. But keep in mind that there are other very valuable skill sets. One of my favorite executives, I talked about Airbnb before, in part because they've helped me survive these last couple of years. I love the brand, but they actually had three founders. And one of the founders was a financial whiz. One of the founders had a great software computer programming background. So he built that amazing platform, which is really what distinguished them from some of the competition at the time. But the third founder went to the Rhode Island School of Design and was a designer who's creative, is a creative.
This is just like my company. When we started our software company, we sold it to Zillow in 2015 and it was the biggest, it was a 9-figure exit. So it was one of the biggest exits in, you know, at the time in Cincinnati.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was a designer, marketer. My buddy Matt was the developer, so he built the platform. And then our other guy whose idea it was, my buddy Austin, you know, it was his idea. He was 18 years old when he bought his first house. He was at law school at the University of Cincinnati. And we spent 18 months at the Panera Bread. It'd be nice if it was a Stuckey's, but it was a Panera Bread. Up on UC's campus, like coming up with the idea and you know, how are we going to build this and doing the user experience and all that other good stuff. But the same thing, it's like your founders, your partners, you got to pick them carefully. And I've had a couple other things that I've done where I didn't really pick my co-founders very, very good, right? But you have to complement each other. You have to have skills that really complement each other. And I think that's really, really important for any startup.
Not only the skills, but the personality. And I think sometimes that gets overlooked, that you have to have complementary emotional skills as well.
That very
emotional
true.
Maturity piece cannot be understated. It's so important to have emotional maturity if you're running a business, because there are going to be really hard times where it's easy to just bust a gasket and lose it.
To
be even keeled and to be grounded and have a strong sense of faith or values or spirituality or meditation or whatever it is that keeps you grounded.
That's right. That's right.
And you got to have that. And if you don't, you're going to become unhinged. And you hear all about these visionary entrepreneur CEOs who just lose it. They become addicted to all kinds of stuff, or they can't manage a company, they can't manage a team. And it's because they lack that emotional maturity.
That's
not something that necessarily comes with age. You can be 18 and be mature, and you can be 55 and be a wreck. So I'm very fortunate that I got a partner who really balances me out well. And it's critical. One of the best quotes I heard was, you should, like you said, you should choose your business partner very wisely, because it is in many ways harder to get out of a business relationship than it is out of a marriage. It's easier to get divorced sometimes than to.
You're probably right. Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, especially if you've got multiple partners. I mean, I guess the only marriage it'd be harder is if you were a polygamist and you were living in Utah somewhere, right? Like that might be the only, that might be the only other time where it's just as hard. But yeah, I mean,
I just don't think people approach it with that mindset, but you should approach it with the same mindset you approach a marriage.
Interesting.
Because this is a partnership. This is a legally binding partnership, just like a marriage is. And you can't just snap your fingers and you're out of it. It gets messy. It gets complicated. Think about a business prenup. Nobody wants to think about that. And I actually used to do some marriage and family law in my background. So you want to be all euphemistic and happy when you're entering into any type of partnership, be it a marriage or a business relationship, but get that exit strategy. That was great advice that I got when I was merging with my partners. If this doesn't work out, what's the clean exit? What's the getaway plan? How do we manage who gets what if we decide this isn't working? And think about that when things are good.
Those are hard conversations to have. To think about the company failing, or you know, what happens if this happens or that happens while you're trying to motivate each other to stay involved, right? And now you have to have conversations, tough conversations about what if. What if this happens? What if that happens? And you know what? I've had partners in businesses that their lives completely changed after we started the business. Everybody was fired up. Everybody was ready to go. And then somebody has three kids. Changes the game, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you and I mean, you know, I'm up there, you know, I'm probably not having any kids, but you know, I don't have to worry about that part. But if you're in your 20s, that's something to think about. I mean, you know, maybe you got a partner who's married and the wife doesn't want to live by the beach anymore. They want to move up to, you know, the big city, New York or something, or they want to go live in, you know, wherever, Colorado, you know, they want to change their life. And, you know, now your partner has to go with them. Communication isn't as good as it was. You can't meet in person. I mean, think about those kind of things. Like, I mean, this stuff happens. Life happens. People's what they want out of life changes. And sometimes it's not even them. Sometimes it could be, you know, friends of theirs, people that influence them that could change it. So picking your partners really, really matters. It sounds like you've got a great one now.
His name is R.G. Lamar.
Okay.
He is a third generation pecan farmer, and we didn't know this until after we merged our two businesses. He had his own pecan snack brand, and so we merged with him, and we still have his brand. We still make his snack brand, and it turns out that we're distant cousins.
Oh, no way.
We have the same great-great-great-grandfather.
Oh, wow.
So I like that we're related.
Did you guys find that on like 23andMe or something, or did just talking?
He has an aunt who's a genealogist, and we talked through it, and realize the connection. So it's not a surprise. He's from the next little town over. So,
oh yeah,
small town Georgia. Everybody's
related. Well, yeah, we just
far enough.
We have I'm part of the Reynolds family in the Virginia, and
RJ Reynolds.
They're like cousins of ours. And
tobacco money, I claim them.
Yeah, but I'm not part of that one. Like, there was the tobacco money split off from the no money, and I'm part of the no money side, right?
Oh, but it's aluminum family, Reynolds aluminum.
They did. They're one of the wealthiest families in the country for a long time, and you go back. We have a family reunion that's lasted 100 years, and I went back to Virginia. And, you know, they're telling all the family history and everything. And, you know, our first ancestor got here at 1610. He was a shipper. He would ship things from Jamestown back to England and bring supplies and go back and forth and everything, which is really cool to learn that history. But when you get there, everybody's like the same, like a Blair or a Reynolds. Those are the two big families. And then there's some Cooks floating around in there too.
Yeah.
But it's like those small towns, you just never know. Like, everybody's kind of, you know, cousins a little bit, you know, or however that works out. But yeah, so, I mean, I love the entrepreneurial spirit. I love the fact that, I mean, this, sometimes I think it's genetic. Sometimes I think that it's just something that's handed down. And, you know, or you see it, right? It could be nurture, right? It's not necessarily nature. It could be nurture. But watching people who have an entrepreneurial spirit not be able to have the opportunity to experience entrepreneurialism for whatever reason. And that's one of the reasons this podcast exists. It's to motivate people. If you're sitting there and you've got a 9-to-5 job, you're miserable, you're pushing paper all day, you know, why not try it? Why not do something? Why not sacrifice like you did? You know, your money was gone. This family member, you didn't come from, you know, tons of family money, right? Yeah. You went to college. That was it. You know, some people are burdened with debt.
Very blessed to have that, though.
Very blessed, because a lot of people. That's right. A lot of people are burdened with that right now. So, but eating ramen noodles, you know, doing an Airbnb, turning your house into an Airbnb. Not everybody can do that. Some people are like, no, this is my personal space. I'm not going to do it.
But then I have the space. I mean, I was lucky in my house, and I had a son who went off to college. So that freed up some space.
Yeah. I mean, I tell people too.
As soon as he went off to college, I turned his bedroom into an Airbnb.
But you got to do what you got to do when you're an entrepreneur. I mean, I rent my car out. You know, I went out and bought a Genesis GV80. I tell people all the time, we actually have an episode on Turo, which is very much like an Airbnb, right?
Sure.
These Turo things, somebody's coming to pick it up tomorrow. I've just had somebody drop it off for 4 days, $800, $200 a day to rent this car, right? Pays for the payment. So I try to tell people about assets. So what you did was you took, somebody goes off to college, you're like, hey, look, I've got an asset sitting here. It's not performing. I'm just living in this house.
Yes.
But Airbnb exists. I need to make money. I need to be able to support myself as I go on this entrepreneurial journey. Rent it out.
Yeah. So think about the skills you have. Think about what is it that you can offer. I've learned that if people are willing to have me give a keynote address, then they should be willing to pay me for it. Oh, I will say another thing about the speaking gig that has really been a game changer for us is we started pitching the speaking gigs as a gift program, an executive gift program for a company. So we do gift tens at the holiday season. And so we now offer, if you want to buy 250 gift tens for your corporate gift program, you know, you get a tin of nuts from companies at the holiday season, right?
Yeah.
And we'll do a sleeve on the gift tin that says whatever your company name is with your logo. And if you buy 250 of these tins or you buy 500 of these tins, I will give your keynote speech.
Oh, throw that in with it too. Yeah. Saving 10 grand right there. Like,
when you speak to my group, I say, well, I would be delighted to if you will have us be your corporate gift program.
So smart.
The cost is $10,000 to purchase these 250 gift tents, and they get their gift program. So everyone wins. And it helps my brand because their gift list gets our product, which happens to have our website on.
They kill two birds with one stone. They need somebody to speak.
Yeah.
They obviously need a gift to send out, right? Boom, boom.
They usually have a budget anyway. So you have to target. It's got to be.
It's not costing you anything extra, you know?
Size.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good idea. So instead of having
to think of ways that are win-wins when you're making some pitches, like you get your gift program done. You already have a budget for that. And you get a keynote address thrown in. So I'm not gonna charge you cash for my keynote. Or you need gifts for your swag bag. A lot of times conferences will have the giveaway, the gift bag. So
totally makes sense.
Buy the product for your gift bag from Stuckey's. Or we can do private label. You want your logo on some candy or some nuts, and we'll put your corporate logo on it.
That also assigns a value to your speech.
Yeah. So then when I'm giving my speech, I'll say, oh, by the way, you can have some samples in your bag. Thank you so much to the Food Manufacturers Association for generously purchasing these products. Yeah. And then you give them a little shout out.
Totally makes sense.
Everyone wins.
This is being an entrepreneur. Coming up with these creative solutions like this.
Yeah, everyone wins. Entrepreneurs solving a problem that people have. And I do think entrepreneurs, you have that in you. And I bet every single one of us who's an entrepreneur can come up with at least one story of us as a kid doing something entrepreneurial.
Oh, yeah. I had my lemonade stand.
I was doing bake sales. I was always baking, and I would set up a little stand outside our house, and I would sell product for money.
Oh, wow.
And then I did babysitting for money.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't anything like super.
But you realized you wanted to make your own way. That's the thing. You wanted to make your own way. You wanted to make your own money because there was things you wanted, and you knew that, hey, if I'm going to get it, I have to go make some money and do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, you hear these stories of famous entrepreneurs, and it's replete with these incidents in their lives. Because I read a lot of biographies. I love biographies. And you'll read, like, Walt Disney as a kid, he grew up so poor, it's heartbreaking. But he was going door to door. He was delivering newspapers. Like, almost every great entrepreneur, right? Like, they grew up poor and hungry, and a lot of them started side hustles or started working at a young age with some business.
Yeah.
Gary Vee. He started working at what, like age 12, maybe eight, child labor.
It was child labor.
Store. Like he wasn't, and he was doing all the marketing and hauling cases of liquor. I mean, he was working his tail off.
And he's a kid working in a wine store or whatever, right? Like shouldn't even be in that place. Yeah. No, he's got a great story. Yeah. I mean, I used to go up to take my red wagon up the hill to Sohio. Remember when Sohio had gas stations? And I'd buy boxes of lemon heads and Boston baked beans and all those little, like, for a nickel is what they used to cost. And then I'd bring them down to my street because none of the other kids could leave the street. And I'd sell them to them for a quarter when they got their allowance. And that was my thing. It was retail.
I used to do that too. I got office supplies, and I would go to this store where I knew I could get really low prices. It was some, I don't know, Five and Dime, back when we had Five and Dimes. And I remember buying up all these fun office supplies, and then I'd take them to my school, and I ran a little store out of my locker, and I would mark up the price.
Nice.
And I sold pencils, and I sold really cool pads, memo pads, and sort of like stationery. I had like a little stationery store out of my locker.
You had a captive audience.
Yeah.
All your customers were already there.
I would have been fourth and fifth grade.
Whoa.
Yeah. So
you were doing it early. Oh, it totally comes naturally. Wow.
Yeah,
wow. That's awesome.
Like a little ledger and keeping up with my profit and just being so excited. Like, oh, I made a dollar this week.
What you're saying right now, I'm sure there's people listening that are, it's connecting, right? It's connecting to them. And they're thinking, that was me. Oh man, I am an entrepreneur. And you know, they're sitting there at their office job or doing whatever. And they're, you know, stewing on the idea of maybe starting a business of their own. What would you tell them? What would you say? Like, what do you like? What are you into? Start a business, do that. Like, what would be you know, the Stephanie Stuckey advice for someone who's listening to this right now and feeling that?
I think the number one consideration is really do a gut check on what is your capacity to manage risk. What's your comfort level? Because not everyone is set out to be an entrepreneur, and that's okay. But just really understand yourself enough to know there are going to be some tough times, and there may be some nights where you're waking up at 3 a.m. worried about whether or not you're going to be able to make payroll. So really do a gut check on, are you okay with having that risk? And it may not even be whether you personally are okay with that, but what are your life circumstances? Like we talked about earlier, if you've got a young family, maybe you want to hold off a little bit. Or if you're thinking about being married, maybe you want to wait a year or two to get married, start having that family if you want to do this entrepreneurial endeavor. So just really do a serious gut check about whether or not you want to do that. And then there's also a way you can manage it and doing a side hustle. Like that's the beauty of a side hustle is when my grandfather started out, and a lot of entrepreneurs, you kept your day job.
That's,
you know,
right.
That saying, don't quit your day job. So he kept your day job. And then in the off hours, my grandfather had his roadside stand. And so can you do something that's truly a side hustle, keep your day job, and then grow that side hustle to the point that you can give up the day job?
I bet if your grandpa was with us.
This is a great podcast too. Not to promote others' podcasts, but they have a lot of great entrepreneurs on there who talk about how they built their brands.
Really good.
So often you'll hear in those stories how they started working evenings, working weekends, and they had their day job that supported them. And it wasn't until they'd scaled to the extent that they could leave and they had a runway of cash reserve that they could
use.
They could really devote full time.
Well, so I mean,
you don't have to plunge.
No, but there's people getting laid off right now and they're getting severance packages. I know a lady, she just got laid off. She got a 2-week severance package and, you know, she applied for unemployment and things like that. I said, this is it. Yeah. This is, you got 2 weeks, you know, look for a job, whatever, but you got 2 weeks. Like there's things that she's wanted to do and she just didn't have time to do it. 2 weeks is a decent amount of time to come up with some ideas. You know, it's not a lot of pay or whatever that she's got, but you know, she's going to be getting unemployment and things like that. You know, I got friends like that, you know, or during COVID, how many people started businesses during COVID? Actually, a lot of women started businesses during COVID. It was like a crazy amount. It was like 80% of the people starting business during COVID were women.
Because we were stuck at home caring for kids. Fortunately, my kids are teenagers, so I didn't have that issue.
But you don't have that problem anymore.
But it's like that, little kids. Oh, I know we're bumping up on the hour, but I will say one other piece of advice that I learned the hard way. And this is not any disrespect for consultants, but if you are tight on cash, do not throw your money away on consultants that you can't afford. And I spent very limited dollars that we had on a marketing firm. They were wonderful. This is not knocking the consultants out there. It's understanding your budget. I guess the bigger picture is don't spend money that you can't afford to. And I didn't realize like how quickly consultants can run through that.
You think it's magic. You think you're just going to come out of the other end of that and you're just going to know all this stuff that, you know, and most of the time these people are just making money off of being consultants. They don't have a business.
And there are some good ones out there, but there are a lot.
They're expensive.
Just like to rack up those billable hours. And again, boom. I didn't have a consultant like that, but they did run through the budget very quickly. And then I was suddenly forced to be my own marketing and branding person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was okay. I think if I had to do it over again, I still would have hired that firm, but I would have hired them for the very limited purpose of putting together some brand guidelines, helping me with some creative artwork and designs that I knew I wouldn't have the capacity myself to do, kind of give me those tools, train me up so I could do it myself.
I actually own an advertising. Yeah, I own an advertising agency. Yeah. And this is what I tell people, the startup people, we have our little package that we offer them for, you know, logo design and branding and a 1-page standards guide. Yeah. That way they know how to be consistent with their brand. But I said, you know what? The social media stuff, you could do that on your own. You could hire your niece to do it. Here's what you do. Create a content calendar. Make sure you got all this stuff. You know, use copy AI to write your blog post. You know, teach them a little bit about SEO. Because you know what? There's no way. Like, I don't want to be like taking money from these. They don't have the money for that, right? You want them to go be successful and then come back to you when they do have a budget, you know, instead of eating up their budget and killing their business at the beginning. So yeah, that's a really good, that's really good advice. Well, talk about where Stuckey's is going, how people can interact with the brand, how they can buy some of those delicious pecans.
So we are laser focused on driving sales right now to become even more profitable. We closed out last year, almost 12 and a half million in sales. That's up from when I bought the company and we were at 2 million in sales. So in 2 years, we increased 10 million in sales. That's gross. And we closed out the year almost 2.5 million profitable. All of it's going back in the company though.
Yep.
It's building the company. Most of it's going towards salaries and we're giving people pay raises and we're hiring up. And so the growth of the company is in selling product. So we just hired a national sales director. She started 2 days ago and our laser focus is getting large national retail chains because that's where we can get the fastest growth. And that growth in sales is going to fuel us being able to buy a new production facility, which we're in the process of. Well, actually, we're hoping to rent because I really would be happy not to tie up capital and another mortgage. So we're looking at a rent, maybe a rent to own situation. And we're looking at some different options. We have 5 sites that we're looking at. And so that's the future for us is to expand our production capacity to really make us the national brand that's known for pecans. So we want to be the go-to brand for pecans on the snack nut aisle. And then we also have the candies. And then eventually, this is further down the road, it's going to cost a lot more, but have some branded locations. But really, I see our focus in the product. I think we had to kind of choose. Are we running stores or are we selling product? Because we only have so much capacity.
Well, and your grandpa answered that question, right?
Yeah. We're still selling the story of the road trip. I still want to have a handful of stores that are very brand forward and celebrate the road trip. So we will always be synonymous with exploring America by car or exploring America, because I would love to be a snack on Delta Airlines. Shameless plea there. But I want us to be the travel brand and the brand that makes you think of exploring and having fun and being with people that you care about.
Well, you need to come up here to Cincinnati. Kroger's headquarters is here. Kroger's the biggest grocery chain in the country, right?
We are pitching to Kroger.
Yeah. Well, and then
we just hired a broker. And the main reason we hired them is their relationships with Kroger. They are really known for getting people in Kroger. So,
oh, well, good. Well, also, if you need a distribution center, there's a this place is known for logistics, supply chain logistics, because we're within we're a day's drive of a third of the U.S. population.
Wow.
Chicago, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Indianapolis, Louisville, Lexington, St. Louis, all Nashville, all within a day, Charlotte, all within a day's drive of Cincinnati. And most of them are an hour and a half away.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So there you go. Logistics, awesome. Logistics so center.
That's us. Yeah. And we continue to drive online sales. We are revamping our website and we're trying to get our distribution center where we're ready to scale for Q4. We got a big strategy session next week on that. So www.stuckeys.com.
Stuckeys.com. And you can buy pecans on there.
You can buy pecan snacks. You can buy our candies and then lots of souvenirs. We have t-shirts, hats, variety of mugs,
all kinds of fun stuff. Swag. I think I did see you in a TikTok or something with like a raccoon hat on.
Yeah, we sell those. We don't sell those on the website right now. We have sold them on the website. We had a road trip, a nostalgic road trip box, and we put them in there.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's
but
fun.
You know, COVID, with all the supply chain issues, we had a hard time getting rubber alligators and coonskin caps. It was tragic.
Oh no, the heritage,
the heritage
of the brand.
We couldn't get coonskin caps and alligators. That was the worst part of COVID for us.
No. Oh no.
I do not mean to make light of COVID.
Well, this is why Grandpa
that was hard for us.
This is why Grandpa manufactured in America and manufactured his own places, because he wouldn't have had these COVID problems.
He didn't have them.
That's right.
That's right.
Well, Stephanie, I really appreciate your time today. And I know everybody listening really appreciate your time. I hope you have a great week. Much success to your business. It sounds like it's already off and running. I mean, $2 million to $12 million a year in gross revenue. You're rocking it out.
Yeah, let's hope so. Knock on wood. We'll keep at it. It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Adam.
Awesome. Thanks, Stephanie. Thanks for joining us on this week's episode of Side Hustle City. Well, you've heard from our guests. Now let's hear from you. Join our community on Facebook, Side Hustle City. It's a group where people share ideas, share their inspirational stories, and motivate each other to be successful and turn their side hustle into their main hustle. We'll see you there, and we'll see you next week on the show. Thank you.